and Albert Allison versus Victoria Equipment and Supply Incorporated. Yes, your argument comes to position.
May it please the court, Mr. David C. Redford will present argument on behalf of Petitioner Allison, and Mr. Jimmy Williamson will present argument on behalf of Petitioner Cherry. Mr. Redford will speak first.
Are you equally dividing the time?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
Right.
15 minutes.
That's fine.
And 7.5 on rebuttal. May it please the court, I'm representing Albert Allison in this case. Albert Allison and Abraham Cherry were two individuals in a, they were injured in a fire down near Victoria and filed a damage action against several defendants. The fire occurred in 1976. And of course, one of those defendants was Melvin Klotzman individually. In the course of discovery in the case, Melvin Klotzman was deposed, and certain testimony was taken from him regarding Victoria Equipment and Supply and their position in the case. It's the position of Abraham Cherry and Albert Allison that we were misled as to the position of Victoria Equipment and Supply as to whether there was a evidence of a cause of action. They were not included at that time. Later, a Joe Pretty was deposition was taken just to find out what he knew about, because he arrived at the scene of the accident immediately thereafter and talked about finding cigarettes, and he was a factual witness. We found out that he did work for Victoria Equipment Supply there on a daily basis with another man, and at that time Victoria Equipment and Supply was included in the case. The statute of limitations was pled as a defense, and a summary judgment was granted on that basis. The basic question, although two points of error were put down in my brief, the basic question is whether there was any factual issue on due diligence to discover a cause of action against Victoria Equipment and Supply under the doctrine of fraudulent concealment. And of course, that is, in a summary judgment context, considering the theory that the law that every reasonable inference must be indulged in favor of the non-movement and doubts resolved in their favor. Three points I'm going to try to cover here, and that the main one is the factual context of whether there was any, whether reasonable minds would differ on this factual question. Number two is the question of this Gulbatkin versus Penn case that the Court of Civil Appeals attempts to use, which I think is a very distorted attempt and creates a lot of problems, and if that is let stand. The third is the Humphrey case, which is the only summary judgment case on due diligence. I think it's quicker, I'm going to start with the Humphrey case, which is the only case on due diligence which is cited by the Court of Civil Appeals or by Mr. Funderburk, the defendant in this case, on due diligence. That's a federal case, Judge Sire, which I believe is quite distinguishable. It's a situation where a racial discrimination case involving April Sound, a man came out and wanted to buy some lots at April Sound, and it was refused twice. Some years later, he learned that it was based on racial discrimination, found some evidence on that basis. He brought suit, and he said that there was fraudulent concealment of the cause of action. And in Judge Sire's opinion, there's no evidence of any type of lying or concealing in any depositions. It was just simply a situation where the man did not pursue the facts. He was denied, Judge Sire points out that he was denied the lots, and I guess from that somebody could conclude that they said there weren't any more lots available, that somebody, that could have excited an inquiry, but there was no other evidence of concealment. Certainly not anything on our basis, where we've got sworn testimony that is at least confusing, if not outright affirmative statements that we should rely on. So I believe that case is very distinguishable. I don't see any factual issues that are compatible in Judge Sire's opinion. Looking at the facts in Melvin Klotzman's deposition, which formed the basis for the fraudulent concealment. And there, I'm looking at the Court of Civil Appeals opinion. There are basically three pages of the deposition, three or four pages, which are relevant in this situation where Victoria Equipment and Supplies name came up. And I have got numbered four statements. Four statements where it was stated positively or very affirmatively that Victoria Equipment and Supply was not working on that well. Page 19, it was stated, were they working on the well? No. Had they been hired to do any work on this well? No. Then a question as to what companies were working on the well, and he names, there were names of several companies, and he did not bring up Victoria Equipment and Supply. And then he states later on that page, no one was working on the well. Later on page 62, it is stated, he talks about Joe Pritty, who was a pumper, and had about his position. You had hired him. He had nothing to do with the well, he says positively. He then says he was working on 89 on other wells that day, in response to a question, he was working on some other wells that day. The only question which would maybe excite an inquiry, or which was the argument that they have relied on, apparently the only fact which has been relied on by the Court of Civil Appeals, is on page 31, where it was stated Mr. Daugherty was taking the deposition. It was stated he, when did he come on the premises, Mr. Pretty? He worked from 7 to 3, 7 to 4 every day, I suppose, checking the wells, production, the compressors, water systems, the leaks, saltwater leaks, well sanding up, and so forth. Albert Allison came in this case after that deposition was taken. And I reviewed the deposition, of course, and at that point determined whether if anybody else needed to be included. And it was my interpretation at that time in reconciling that statement, and I think it's a reasonable interpretation. If you take wells, W-E-L-L apostrophe S, and put the apostrophe after the S, you're talking about the wells, 89, 90. This man, Pretty, was covering the Victoria area as far as being a pumper, and I reconcile that as a court reporter's error or just as a misinterpretation, because there were so many positive statements that he was not working on the well. Now, what's curious to me, and we can get into this, the Court of Civil Appeals rationale here, but he goes to some length about the fact that this was a, Klotzman wasn't lying, because this was a not a producing well, and so Victoria Equipment and Supply wasn't working out there, and that's what he meant. Well, how does he reconcile this statement if he believes that we're talking about the well, apostrophe S, production, that he was working out there? He's either lying in one place or another, or misleading in one place or another. The fact is, and then he goes on to say that, we couldn't have been surprised by Joe Freddy's deposition, and he picks out, talking about picking and choosing parts of a, which is Mr. Funderburk's argument, he picks out a part on page 53, the top part of page 53, a statement about the fact that Pretty would take care of the well, W-E-L-L-S. He would gauge the well, check the gauge flow, et cetera, et cetera. If he looks at the bottom of page 53, and that, I was taking that deposition, I was asking those questions, and that's when my stomach told me that we had to include Victoria Equipment and Supply. Up to that time, they were talking in a general sense about Joe Pretty working in the area and working on wells, but in the bottom of page 53, we start talking about when he's working there, and he and a man named Raymond Rodriguez, who was his person who was working with him, and I won't go over all the statements, but he says, had Raymond been there that day? Answer, he was there that morning to get the well pressure reading and so forth and call into that office. And the question before, he talks about the fact that Raymond Rodriguez and he alternated every other day. That showed that he was working there every day, clearly. Page 83, it was, he in 82, he really admits that Victoria Equipment and Supply's duty was to check on whether there was gas coming out of the well, and that was the cause of this accident. He said there was a duty on our part to check on that. He thinks it was Mac Services, which is Albert Allison's employer, to also check. But he says it was their duty to check that, going out there every day, and clearly that admitted to a clear cause of action. But it was the Court of Civil Appeals chose to ignore those things, which clearly put them on the premises working that day. So I believe, I don't know what the Court of Civil Appeals apparently thinks, that if there's any tidbit of evidence that would excite an inquiry on the part of a lawyer or a party, that is summary judgment material. A summary judgment has to be entered. And I would say certainly if there's a reasonable position, a reasonable construction that would put us in a position of being misled or concealed, that would form a fact issue for the jury. We get into this Galvinson versus Penn, in which, again, this statement, it's a summary judgment case in which they found that there was summary judgment shouldn't have been granted. Then the court goes on to just quote something about equitable estoppel in the last paragraph, which is just complete dicta. And he takes the last sentence out of that and forms the basis for the, he says, there are two reasonable constructions, or two constructions, then a lawyer should pursue one of them if one of them is inconsistent, and that means it's a summary judgment. There's nothing following that case through the citator. It was a quote from Corpus Juris Secundum. File has been cited in by Missouri cases. There's nothing that has been summary judgment situation from that statement. So I believe it is fodder for a bit of chaos if that construction is taken. Now I believe we look at the case of Long versus Smith, and we see that we have the right, if a principal testifies affirmatively, in that case it was a situation where the president testified to ownership, and the court, I don't think there was a lot of conflicting evidence, but it said they had a right to rely on that positive statement. I think there were three or four positive statements by Mr. Klotzman on which we had a right to rely. I think that Long case, plus the fact that any reasonable inferences must be indulged in our favor, creates clearly a fact issue on due diligence. Now, looking at the cases of Mr. Funderburk, none of these cases are summary judgment cases. They're simply cases on which there have been jury findings, and the court has upheld jury findings regarding due diligence. I'm speaking of Clifton versus Ogle and Field Measurement Service versus Ives. Covering briefly, I don't know whether it's before the court, but on his counterpoint, and the Court of Civil Appeals certainly did not rely on it, talks about the question of whether there is fraudulent concealment of a party or fraudulent concealment of a cause of action. And I think if you look at those two cases, this concealment of a party is really a very confusing situation. It started with this Griffin versus Shannon case, in which people were just missing for 37 years. And they didn't conceal themselves intentionally, they were just, the person couldn't find them. And the idea of concealment of a party, the language came into it, and this Otis case cited that case. And in this case, certainly Victoria Equipment was known. That party wasn't being concealed. The cause of action was the thing that was being being concealed, the facts relevant to whether Victoria Equipment and Supply were working there was what was concealed. So in looking at the Court of Civil Appeals opinion, they don't say so, but they're saying that if there's any smidgling of evidence about excitement that would excite a lawyer's inquiry, that would cause a summary judgment. And I simply think that there is nothing to support that in the law. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Jimmy Williamson. I practice with Larry Doherty in Houston, Texas. And we are the attorneys for Abraham Cherry, a co-applicant before the case. I would like to briefly emphasize a few additional facts. One is Mr. Klossman was deposed before the 2-year statute of limitations was up. There is no doubt he was deposed like 2 months before the 2-year statute of limitations ran on this case. And the statute that controls the case, I think it would be agreed, is 5526, which is a 2-year statute for personal injury. Second is, at all times, including when he was deposed, as shown by his deposition and his affidavit filed in the summary judgment proceedings, he owned 50% of Victoria Equipment and Supply. He was an officer of Victoria Equipment and Supply, and at the time that Victoria Equipment and Supply was a partnership, he was a 50% partner. So he was definitely in a position to know exactly the position of Victoria Equipment and Supply with relation to that well in question. And in fact, Mr. Preti's testimony, which is before the court in deposition, which was taken at some point later, because Mr. Preti was also a fact witness to certain events concerning the actual case itself, indicated that Mr. Klossman had knowledge every day of the activities on that well by Victoria Equipment and Supply. And Mr. Klossman was reported to every day regarding the activities on that particular well. His statements, my only disagreement with opposing counsel or my co-counsel, is that I feel that his statements were absolutely affirmative misrepresentation. Every time he brought up the issue of the entity of Victoria Equipment and Supply in his deposition, counsel pursued that matter and said, tell us exactly what the position of Victoria Equipment Supply is with relation to this well. And every time he said nothing. He said, quote, they had nothing to do with this well. Or, quote, had he been hired to do anything on this well? Answer, no. There weren't any sort of evidence, you know, that Victoria Equipment Supply was related to this particular well at all. The Court of Appeals has, in its opinion, drawn a distinction. Now, I would like to say that the issue of fraudulent concealment is an affirmative defense to limitation. I think we, therefore, are under a burden to show that there was a concealment. To defeat summary judgment, I think we are under a burden to show there was a concealment and to show we relied upon that concealment. You know? And then the issue is, did we know, there's no evidence we knew of said concealment, or should we have known of said concealment? We're in the exercise of reasonable diligence, should Mr. Doherty and Mr. Redford know of this concealment? And there's absolutely no showing that they should have. In fact, the showing in Mr. Klotzman's deposition is that they diligently tried to seek out the facts regarding Victoria Equipment and Supply, that they returned that issue 4 separate times over a 60-page deposition, and that they returned that again. They asked him to list every person who was involved in this well. He did not list Victoria Equipment and Supply, even though, as he testified, he owned 50% of it, and Victoria Equipment and Supply was in a position where they were checking the well every day, and he did not list them as a person participating in the well. In fact, the merits of the suit, which are not before the court, but which are in the record, show that, in fact, Victoria Equipment and Supply may have been, as you see Mr. Prete's testimony on page 83, I think, testified Victoria Equipment and Supply personnel
may have been the personnel responsible for shutting off the gas valve, which in fact may have ignited the fire. Those are the merits of the case. But the point to be made about that is, there is evidence that Victoria Equipment and Supply was related to this well in a very significant way that can affect the merits. And for him to testify that if they had nothing to do with the well, they were not hired to do any work on the well, it is just absolutely false. And he was under oath to tell the truth, and he was in a position to tell the truth, and that was before limitation training. And the evidence is that Victoria Equipment and Supply was not sued expressly based on Mr. Flopson's deposition testimony.
So you're saying that concealment is a matter of law?
No, sir. I'm not. I'm saying it's a fact issue. I think that there is concealment, but I must say that I do not think that estoppel, the circumstances in which estoppel will be applied as a matter of law, are very, very rare. As a matter of fact, Gulbenkian versus Penn, which has been cited dozens of times, is an estoppel case where the plaintiff obtained summary judgment on estoppel. The trial court held estoppel as a matter of law, and what the Supreme Court did then, it reversed and said, no, there's a fact issue. Estoppel is always a fact question. And that's the point. And that's all we say here, is that estoppel, the question of what we knew or should have known, is a fact issue, and should go to the jury. I have no real disagreement with the Court of Appeals' statement of the law concerning fraudulent concealment. That law is pretty well set forth in Weaver versus Witt and Nichols, both of which, Nichols was cited by the Court of Appeals, concerning what we have to prove in order to maintain fraudulent concealment. I have a serious disagreement with the Court of Appeals as to their conclusions from the facts. They drew certain conclusions about the facts, including a distinction between producing wells and non-producing wells. There is no such distinction that I can find in the record. No one ever said, Mr. Klotzman's testimony was never, now, they weren't working on this well because, and by working, I mean a producing well. Or, they never made that sort of distinction. There is one line in the testimony that said Prete dealt with producing wells. So, the construction of the Court of Appeals that there's some sort of distinction between producing and non-producing wells, I do not think is supported by the testimony, and especially when you consider that after that testimony was given concerning this producing problem, well, again, the attorneys twice more went back to the issue of Victoria Equipment and Supply and said, all right, tell us who was involved in this well. All right, did they have anything to do with this well? And the answer is no. I do not think that that amounts to concealment as a matter of law. I do think that that raises an issue as to what we knew or should have known. And I do not think the Court of Appeals, or I do think the Court of Appeals was in error in saying you should have known, or the issue is should you have known, and saying we will decide that issue based upon what I think is at the very best conflicting testimony, and what I think is testimony in our favor, and then say, and we will decide that issue as a matter of law. I do not think that's the purpose of summary judgment, and I know that, and I think that's the only issue before the court, is whether we had any issue, any evidence, or whether the evidence was such that we should have known, or whether that's a fact issue. I will say one more thing, and that is the case of Long that Mr. Redford has cited seems to be the most directly on point case that I have discovered and is cited. But where in that case is when the facts are not as strong as here. The corporate president who made those misrepresentations was not under oath, and he made them to a third party. And here this person was under oath and was in a position to know the truth and just basically withheld it. As soon as we found out the situation regarding this, we sued Victoria Equipment and Supply. I wish to address very briefly one additional argument that's been raised by a respondent, and that is the argument that all they concealed was the identity of their party. They didn't really conceal a cause of action. It is true that Abraham Cherry knew he was hurt on the day of the fire. There's no doubt about that. But we also knew of the existence of Victoria Equipment and Supply before. We know of the existence of a company known as Victoria Equipment and Supply before 2 years was up. We did not know of their relationship to the cause of action, and that was what was concealed from us. Their identity was not concealed from us. What was concealed from us was that they were checking that well every day, that they were responsible for the gas flow on that well, and possibly responsible for making sure that gas flow was turned off. Now, that was concealed for us, and that is material facts concerning the cause of action. That is not facts concerning their identity. Thank you very much, and I'll reserve some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Counselor. We'll hear a response from the respondent.
Okay, please report. Mr. Larry Funderburk will present argument on behalf of the respondent.
May it please the court. I represent Victoria Equipment and Supply Company, the respondent in this case. I think it would perhaps be helpful if I expanded a little bit more on the background of this case, if the court will indulge me to do so. This accident occurred on the site of an oil well near Victoria in October of 1976. The plaintiffs, Mr. Cherry and Mr. Allison, were employees of a company called Mack Services, which provides oil field labor. They came to the site of the oil well in order to clean out a sludge tank or a sludge pit. It was a metal tank. There was nobody at the well as they were working there. Gas was venting from a pipe into the sludge tank where they were working. While they were cleaning out the sludge tank with shovels, the gas ignited, and both Mr. Allison and Mr. Cherry were burned. This occurred in October of 1976. Sometime in 77, Mr. Cherry filed his lawsuit, and the deposition of three defendants, including Melvin Klotzman, who was the operator of the well. He also sued a company called Vitol and a company called R&S Services. Vitol was the lessee, and the R&S Services had rented the metal tank where the men were working. He did not sue Victoria Equipment and Supply Company. About 6 weeks before the statute of limitations ran, before the 2 years was up, Mr. Cherry's attorney took the deposition of Melvin Klotzman, who was then one of the defendants in the case. And it's that deposition which really is at the center of this case, because it's what Mr. Klotzman said or didn't say that forms the basis for the plaintiff's contentions of fraudulent concealment. He was asked some questions about Victoria's involvement with the well. It is true that on one occasion he said they were not working on the well. It is true also that he said they had nothing to do with the well. In the same deposition, however, he went on to very carefully and meticulously explain what their involvement was. He said they supplied the pumpers and the gaugers for the well. He was asked how he found out about the fire, and he said, well, he heard about it from Joe Creedy, who was the first one there after the fire and discovered it. And he said, now who does Joe Creedy work for? He works for Victoria Equipment and Supply Company. What's their involvement? He said, well, they supply the pumpers and the gaugers. They're out there every day, 7 to 3, doing various tasks on the well, including checking leaks, sanding up, so forth. So what we have here is, at the very worst, from my standpoint, I contend, testimony from Mr. Klotzman, which is ambiguous or contradictory. Now, I'm going to discuss in a moment why it is my position that this did not amount to a concealment at all. But simply for the purposes of argument, I will say that arguably they received in that deposition some ambiguous or conflicting testimony from Mr. Kossman. But let me go ahead with the rest of the background of the case. After that deposition was taken, Victoria was not added as a party defendant. In fact, no further discovery was done for another year and a half, at which time Joe Preedy's deposition was taken. Joe Preedy is the man who Mr. Klotzman identified as having discovered the fire, as having come to the premises on the day that it happened, and being an employee of Victoria Equipment and Supply Company. It was after that deposition was taken, it's now 3.5 years after the accident, that they then filed the lawsuit against Victoria Equipment and Supply Company. We pled the statute of limitations and filed a motion for summary judgment based upon the statute of limitations. It was granted by the trial court. At the hearing, when the motion for summary judgment came on for hearing, the only summary judgment evidence, well, the only answer to the, or response to the motion for summary judgment was an unsworn response by Mr. Doherty, one of Mr. Cherry's attorneys. We introduced the deposition of Melvin Klotzman as our summary judgment evidence. The trial court granted the summary judgment and announced that ruling. Thereafter, Mr. Cherry's attorney and Mr. Allison's attorney filed a motion for rehearing. And attached to that motion for rehearing, for the first time, there appeared an affidavit by each attorney saying that there was fraudulent concealment and that we relied upon that fraudulent concealment and we relied upon it as to the discovery of a cause of action, not simply the identity of a party.
Are you suggesting for a response on a motion for summary judgment to be acceptable, it's got to be sworn to?
I'm saying that there was not any summary judgment evidence before the trial court at the time of the hearing except an unsworn pleading.
You're not saying it had to be sworn. That's not the argument you're making, is it?
Well, there wasn't. That's not really the argument I'm making, Justice Kilgarland, but there wasn't any summary judgment evidence at the time of the hearing except the deposition of Melvin Klotzman. Now later on, before the judgment was signed, the plaintiffs had filed a motion for rehearing to which was attached affidavits by each attorney. But at the time of the hearing, there was not any, the only summary judgment evidence before the court was the deposition of Melvin Klotzman. Now, and of course, the Court of Appeals affirmed that summary judgment, and we're now here as the respondent in the action. The point that I want to make is, and I think the Court of Appeals was correct in holding that the petitioners here have failed to sustain their burden of raising a fact issue as to every element of fraudulent concealment. I think it takes more than just saying he told us something that wasn't correct and we relied upon it, and therefore there is fraudulent concealment and that avoids the statute of limitations. There's more to fraudulent concealment than just a misrepresentation. There's got to be a material misrepresentation made with knowledge of its falsity, with the intention that it be acted upon, and reasonable reliance must have been placed on it. And I underline that because I think it's important as to whether or not there was reasonable reliance placed upon any alleged misrepresentation to the detriment of the person claiming. Now, as I said a minute ago, even if we concede for the purpose of this argument that there was some misrepresentation or some concealment. There is no showing by the petitioners in this case of any reasonable reliance upon it. The reason I say that is because in the very same deposition, on the very same day that he received the testimony, which he says was amounted to concealment, he also received testimony that Victoria Equipment and Supply Company had a very definite connection with the well. Now, I'm aware of the court's admonitions to attorneys that they should not be read to, but because this page of testimony is so crucial to this case, I'm going to ask the court's indulgence to let me read a portion of page 31 of Melvin Klotzman's testimony. His answer was to Mr. Doherty, who was taking his deposition, "The only person that I talked to on this thing other than the Mac Services man was the pumper who informed me of the fire and wanted to know what was going on because the gate was open. And I called Mac Services and found out what was going on in relation to the vacuum truck to the barges. He shut the well in. He found cigarettes and either one or two lighters in the tank. I can't remember." Question by Mr. Doherty, "Who was this?" Answer, "His name was Joe Preete, P-R-E-I-T-E, as I've stated before." Question, "And who did he work for?" Answer, "Victoria Equipment and Supply, as I've stated before." Mr. Van Winkle, who represented Mr. Klotzman in the case. "He's the pumper?" Question mark. Answer, "He's the pumper." Question by Mr. Doherty, "When did he come on the premises?" Answer, "He worked from 7 to 3, 7 to 4, every day, I suppose, checking the well's production, the compressors, water systems, the leaks, saltwater leaks, well, standing up, so forth." Question, "Who paid for his work effort on that job?" Answer, "Victoria Equipment was his direct employer, but he was billed to them, he was billed by them to Vital Resources." So what we're saying is that in that same deposition, Mr. Klotzman very clearly explained to Mr. Doherty, Mr. Cherry's attorney, the connection that Victoria Equipment and Supply Company had to the well in question. When you get conflicting answers about somebody's involvement, you can't contend that there was fraudulent concealment because the reliance upon it has to be reasonable. And the cases are replete that there is a duty to further investigate ambiguous or conflicting information. In this case, we have no effort on the part of the petitioners to go forward and resolve that conflict or ambiguity. What they have simply said is that we relied upon it to our detriment, and that's why we didn't file our suit within 2 years. But what did they do with the information that suggested or told them very clearly that Victoria had a connection with the well? Nothing. Mr. Preedy's deposition was not taken for another year and a half. So we're saying that they have not raised a fact issue as to every element of fraudulent concealment. And the most significant element that they missed is reasonable reliance upon that testimony. Now, did Mr. Klotzman really conceal anything? This was a workover well. And I think the Court of Appeals very perceptively saw that what we had here and commented upon it in its opinion. What we had here was simply a failure to communicate between the attorney and the witness. Working on a well and gaugers and pumpers in oil field parlance are two different things. This was a workover well. It was shut down for the purpose of testing and evaluation at the time the accident occurred. I think it's fairly clear when you read the deposition as a whole and you don't take statements out of context that what Mr. Klotzman was saying was that they had nothing to do with the workover operation or the operation of the well. What their involvement was certain record keeping and miscellaneous tasks to do with it. They were the pumpers and the gaugers, not the operators, and they didn't work on it. If you read it in that context, there is not any there's not any concealment at all. But certainly, if they were thrown off the track of Victoria Equipment and Supply Company by his answers, they were at the same time put back on the track by his further testimony in the same deposition that they were there every day. They had a man there every day performing certain tasks, and one of them was checking for leaks. That was told to them in that same deposition. And we simply say that under those circumstances, there has been no fraudulent concealment as a matter of law, and that reasonable minds cannot differ about it. Now, surely, at the very least, when they were told by Melvin Klotzman that Victoria had a man there on the day of the accident, that he's the one that discovered the fire, and that they had certain duties such as checking for leaks, sanding up, keeping charts, checking the production, and so forth, it must have excited inquiry. And that's what these cases say, that you can't rely upon concealment. You can't ignore means at your hand, at hand, from testimony. If it is excited inquiry, then that in itself will defeat fraudulent concealment. You can't claim to be fraudulently concealed if you had sufficient information that with reasonable diligence you could have discovered the true facts. But what happened? Having received this information in September of 78, 6 weeks prior to the expiration of 2 years, Mr. Preedy's deposition was not taken until March of 1980. There was no further attempt to clarify or resolve the conflict or the difficulty in Mr. Klotzman's testimony. Even in its very worst light, the testimony is no more than conflicting or ambiguous. And I would also suggest that this reasonable reliance must continue up until suit is filed. I don't see how somebody can say, because we were told something that was misleading, even though we may have been told something else that told us the true picture, we can simply rely upon the misleading part of it ad infinitum and do nothing about the part of the testimony which told us the true involvement of Victoria Equipment and Supply.
Is there anything in there that he indicated, Klotzman indicated, that he was working on another well, a different well, not on this one?
I know, Your Honor, that has been argued, that interpretation has been argued by the
petitioner. Well, what is the language on page 62?
How about explain
other
that?
Than exactly that.
Explain that.
Well, I don't know if I know.
Lines 12 to 16.
Well, it's true that he said he had nothing to do with that. He was working on other wells that day. Yes, that's right. But also at the same time, he didn't ever say any place in the deposition that he never worked on this well. He was working. It's true that he had other wells to cover besides this one, but we know he was on the premises of this well this day, the day the accident occurred, because he's the one that discovered the fire.
Even though he says he had nothing to do with the well?
That's right.
He was just driving by, for the impression he tried to leave, didn't he? Just